The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
The problem with deterrence is it goes on in the mind of your adversary. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a Bulwark contributor, and I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, we're finally getting some sun and some above freezing temperatures. Is your driveway melted off and cleaned off yet?
It's melted off. Of course, now we have all the crud that we spread on the driveway. But the good news is that there'll be a heavy wintry mix and rain all day Sunday. So if we don't get hypothermia, then at least we'll clear that away. Listen, basically I'm doing okay. I hope you're doing okay. When we began our jackassery segment of Shield of the Republic, I was worried that there might not be enough material. And, as we discussed before the show, actually we're drowning in a wealth of stuff. So I'm going to tick off at least three pieces of jackassery that struck me this week. And I know you've got your list. So the first is Pete Hegseth deciding that no military officers should get graduate degrees at Harvard because it's infested with woke stuff. That presumably includes the medical school, physics, engineering, stuff like that. And of course, Hegseth himself got a degree at the Kennedy School. Now, you might say that Harvard deserves it for having given us Pete Hegseth, and I would listen to that argument. But this really is juvenile behavior. Second is that the government shuts down El Paso Airport for 10 days so that the Border Patrol can use lasers to shoot down party balloons. And then they realize that maybe it's not such a good idea to shut down a really big airport to shoot down a bunch of party balloons.
Or for the Department of Defense to share some of its most advanced toys with the Border Patrol.
Right, like these guys, like you would trust Greg Bovino with this sort of stuff. And then my favorite this week is Christy Noem, who continues to cover herself, and somebody who's probably her paramour, Corey Lewandowski, although they're both married, but we're not going to dwell on that too much. No, we're not going to judge. Flying into a rage at her Coast Guard pilot because she left her blanket, or as some would say, blankie, on an airplane. So she fired him. So she was really mad that the blanket got left on the airplane. But then she realized, apparently a little bit late in the game, that nobody else could fly the airplane. So she had to rehire him to fly her back. Hopefully she was reunited with her blankie, and then she can go back to cosplaying, being a SEAL or
ICE agent,
Delta, whatever. So those are just a sampling of the rich array of jackasseries that I saw. What about you? I know you've got a list too.
Before we leave Christy Noem and Corey Lewandowski, the anecdote you just recounted comes from a Wall Street Journal, very lengthy Wall Street Journal article about not just some of those personal peccadilloes, but about the vicious infighting among and between various, you know, MAGA elements, including, you know, Kristi Noem fighting with Tom Homan, the border czar, flying into a rage with director of ICE Lyons over, you know, differences about, you know, tactical differences about how to carry out mass, you know, deportation. And as I mentioned to you in an earlier conversation, all of this reminds me, you know, of the sort of vicious bureaucratic infighting in the Nazi regime between the SA and the SS, you know, which ultimately led to the, to the bloodletting of the Night of the Long Knives, except this is the dumbed down version of it.
Yeah, this is really the Keystone Cops version of it. I mean, that's really, or like, you know, in the old days when you'd go to a circus, you know, clowns hitting each other over the head with Nerf bats and stuff like that, and dumping ice buckets of ice water on each other's head. I mean, it's, I mean, there's a serious issue, and there's actually one I may return to at the end of your section, which is one of the ways in which Trump has really gotten himself stuck in this term, as opposed to his first, when he was ready to fire everybody. He's not willing to fire anybody who's really senior and visible, and because he's not willing to give a scalp to the libs. But of course, that means he's stuck with a bunch of bozos. I mean, I didn't even mention Pam Bondi just turning into this wild-eyed monster in front of the House, insulting people who, I have to admit it, have better law degrees than she does, you know, being incredibly rude and just, it, you know, but they're stuck with her, even though she's clearly not up to the job either.
Well, I've got my own jackassery that I can add to this mix, and God knows we got to stop, because then we're going to get on to like more serious matters. But Thomas Rose, the U.S. Ambassador to Poland, has basically begun alienating one of the most pro-American countries in Europe, and one of the ones that is perhaps the most sympathetic to the Trump administration, which is Poland, by cutting off relations with the third-ranking official in Poland, the president of their upper house, because he had the temerity to suggest that he didn't think Donald Trump really deserved the Nobel Peace Prize. And for that intolerable insult to the honor of the United States of America, Ambassador Rose decided, you know, to cut off all U.S. contact with this person, which has created a bit of a kerfluffle in Poland. You know, I raise this in part because we still have a huge number of vacancies among ambassadorships, and about 90%, which is way out of whack with the norm, of the nominations that have been made by the Trump administration are, you know, political appointees. And you know, I raise this because I think it may not be completely obvious to a lot of our viewers and listeners, but U.S. ambassadors in the countries, you know, that host them actually are the face of the country in many ways. And, you know, they can cut a very big swath in the, you know, the local society. And, you know, having these clowns, you know, put forward by the administration to represent the United States really comes at a cost, you know, in our standing. And you can see it reflected now in the Pew polls about our standing. I mean, some of it's Trump, but a lot of it is these, you know, idiots who've been appointed to these positions. And not to, you know, we really do need to get onto serious matters, but there's also the nomination of Jeremy Carl to be Assistant Secretary for International Organizations. You know, this is a role that's been filled by very serious people. Our friend Elliot Abrams had it in the Reagan administration. And this is, you know, a Claremont Institute guy who has no you know, apparent qualification. But to add insult to injury, he's a Jewish convert to Christianity who has now espoused some extremely you know, vile, anti-Semitic, and white supremacist views. So much so that at least one Republican senator has said he cannot support him, and I think there are going to be others who will find it impossible to support that nomination either.
Yeah, no, he's frantic. There was a story that he's frantically trying to delete 5,000 tweets. Meanwhile, of course, the Commission on Religious Liberty had to kind of ease out a former, I think she was a Miss California or something like that, who was objected because, of course, the Jews killed Christ. I mean,
why would anyone think that's anti-Semitic?
You know, just one other thing I think along these lines, and I want to make a larger point here, is there was an interesting piece in the Washington Post by Mark Thiessen, who had been in the George W. Bush administration, but I think it's fair to say has been, I think we can say Trump adjacent, and certainly anti-Trump, going after Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake, the utterly incompetent head of Voice of America, for basically doing her level best to shut down our Iranian service at a time when we really need her. And he's like tearing his hair out. So you got to get rid of this person. But again, it is the same sort of thing. Lord knows it's problematic enough at the cabinet level. But below that, they're also, you know, they've got these wackos. And I think there is a larger significance here. As you know, I've been mere gloom to your doom throughout all this. I do think that the administration's pratfalls and incompetence, you are seeing various kinds of pushback. I don't think Thiessen would have written this kind of column 6 months ago.
Yeah,
and I think there are, and I don't think. I mean, it's pretty clear that the Carl administration nomination is going to get deep sixed. You know, the vote on tariffs, which the Republicans did not want to take, because then, you know, the Republican members of Congress are going to be in the unfortunate position of either having to vote with the president and say we love tariffs and annoy all their constituents,
which are attacked,
or vote against tariffs and annoy the president, which they don't want to do either. And Mike Johnson couldn't stop that. Or even Mike Johnson, Speaker of the House, ticking off the Department of Justice for tracking any member of Congress who is looking at the Epstein files, which we'll talk about at the end of the show. So my line all along is political gravity still operates, and we're going to be seeing more of it over time. But we can return to that maybe at the end.
If from your lips to God's ear. A lot of viewers have in the comments have asked that we at least preview the Munich Security Conference, which is started convening today, and over the weekend we'll have its big speech. So we'll have to review that retrospectively maybe next week in brief. You and I have both attended this conference in the company of the late Senator John McCain in the past. Could you maybe explain what the Munich Security Conference is to people?
Sure.
Of course, it was last year. It was the scene of a kind of, I would say, very gauche speech by Vice President J.D. Vance, who kind of assailed European culture. And you've seen a lot of those themes resurface in the national security strategy that was published in December. But maybe just explain the background and history of the Munich Security Conference to folks.
I'll parenthetically say it's interesting that he canceled his attendance this year. That will be represented by Rubio. So this began with, I think it was Ewald von Kleist, who had been a young Wehrmacht officer, but in the resistance. I think he'd been part of the Moltke plot, the July plot, as a very young officer, who in the 1960s, I'm thinking, thought it would be a good idea to try to bring together American and European defense specialists for a gathering, which was then called Wehrkunde, which is basically a defense meeting, national security meeting. At that time, it was relatively small. You could all fit into one hotel, the Hotel Bayerischer Hof in Munich. You and I would go, there would always be a very strong bipartisan congressional delegation. And then they would bring along the troubadours and the court jesters, of whom you and I were frequently members. But it was really a conference of several hundred people, all told, maybe a little bit less, very, very serious, both officials, experts, and so on. It has grown and grown over the years. I personally think that's somewhat problematic. So it's sort of like the Davos for the national security set. I think they've got some ridiculous number of cabinet officials and heads of state, like 50 or 60. They can have the main meeting in the hotel, but unless you're a cabinet level official, you're not gonna be able to sit in the main room. So there, people are in all kinds of other hotels, as is often the case. It's a place to go for the meetings that you're going to have outside, bilats, as they say, bilateral meetings. But it has become a big gathering, and it has been the scene of a number of dramatic speeches. There was, before the Iraq War, sort of a standoff between Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and the then German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer. There's been times, I think we both saw a McCain-Lavrov smackdown. I think Putin came once and gave a
yes, in 2007, gave a speech with Bob Gates in the audience.
Very dark speech. So, people watch it. People particularly watch who the Americans send and what they say, and then who, from the host country, the Germans. In this case, what's interesting is the speech will be given by Rubio, and we haven't heard that. That'll be tomorrow. So next week, you and I should talk about that. As you mentioned, it was Vance. Interesting that Vance is not coming this year. The one sort of foretaste that we had of all this, though, was a speech made by the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, so your successor at several removes, Bridge Colby, to the NATO ministerial. So I guess first you have a meeting with all the NATO, senior NATO officials, which I read as innocuous. Now, normally innocuous is not good enough. On the one hand, it's a speech that didn't mention Russia, but it was a speech that reaffirmed the importance of NATO, the importance of the alliance, that echoed a lot of the themes that we've talked about here. Europeans have to do more on their own. We're looking at our own hemisphere. We're looking at the Indo-Pacific. But I thought, for me, the bottom line there is, no, we're not quitting NATO. So it wasn't the speech that, you or I would have wanted. It's not the speech John McCain would have given. But compared to what we thought the administration would be like, or could have been like, I think it's not so bad.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Race to savings for your next project when you shop at Menards. Get the comfort and support you need with a new mattress from Serta. Find the perfect mattress for a deep and restorative night's sleep. Take control of your sleep and save big money on Serta mattresses now at Menards. Plus, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and race to savings on more great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. There was also a speech by the German Chancellor, Friedrich Merz, who I think is, really one of the most formidable, certainly one of the most formidable chancellors they've had in a while, but also one of the more formidable European leaders. Maybe you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So Chancellor Merz spoke today and basically reiterated that, you know, Europe needs the United States, the United States needs Europe. It was a kind of affirmation of the ongoing importance of, you know, the transatlantic relationship and therefore the importance of trying to patch over our, you know, differences that have emerged. And you know, Colby's comments today, in addition to the speech you mentioned that he gave at NATO, the very similar comments at Munich, and the reporting about what Rubio is likely to say, we'll have to see what he actually says, but do suggest that there's sort of an effort to show a more, you know, emollient, you know, the Trump administration with a human face, you might say, you know, to our European colleagues. And so that's, you know, I agree with you. That's all well and good. I just would point out just a couple of things. One, you rightly noted that in his speech to the NATO ministerial, and by the way, the fact that, you know, without any disrespect to undersecretaries for policy at the Department of Defense, the fact that he is representing the United States rather than the Secretary of Defense tells you something.
Too busy working out.
Yeah, doing push-ups. But, you know, his speech did not mention Russia, as you said. This is becoming a pattern. He went a week or two ago to South Korea and gave a speech that, you know, about U.S.-Korean defense ties and relations, made no mention of North Korea. He himself, of course, you know, has sort of made his kind of national security bones a couple of years ago with a book arguing that the defense of Taiwan was, you know, the, you know, ne plus ultra of U.S. objectives around the world. And, the national defense strategy that was released 2 weeks ago that we talked about makes zero mention of Taiwan. So there is a bit of a pattern that is emerging, you know, that is creating strategic ambiguity or reasserting strategic ambiguity, but in ways that, you know, I think could be a little worrisome. So something to keep an eye on.
Yeah. And but Eric, I would just say to that, I mean, there are two explanations of this. One, deep significance, a pattern, it reveals something about his thought. The other is, he's just not very good.
Okay, well, you can say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
But I mean, I know what quality looks like.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I would say one other thing about Chancellor Merz, which is, while I think it's good that he has, you know, said we need to maintain the transatlantic link, not as dire as the sort of Mark Carney speech at Davos, which I think is a good thing. I mean, I think prematurely declaring NATO dead and buried is bad and dangerous for us and for Europe. And so I think that's all to the good. On the other hand, today, the Financial Times reports that he's quietly been engaged in conversations with President Macron of France about, you know, the French nuclear umbrella and how it might be extended to defend Germany against Russia if, you know, the United States kind of abandons extended nuclear deterrence. And, you know, there are problems there because France is not part of the nuclear planning group of NATO. It probably never will be. French doctrine, very clear that, you know, nuclear weapons are meant to defend France. I mean, doctrine can be changed, but I mean, this is not something that is going to be easily accomplished. And there are also technical obstacles to, you know, European deterrence being sufficient to, you know, actually deter, Russia. So there's hedging going on in addition to trying to keep the transatlantic relationship going, which is completely understandable under the circumstances, but I just think tells you a little bit about where we are.
Yeah, so look, you and I would be doing the same thing if we were in the shoes of European leaders, and it's entirely reasonable. I think also we're all very caught in the moment, understandably, and worried about the next 3 years. You know, I think there's a good chance that after that you have something that's sort of a reversion to the mean, but you're not going to be in the same place. I mean, we've discussed this before. I think this administration has managed to really shake European confidence in the United States and indeed allied confidence in the United States in some pretty fundamental ways. I also think, just apropos of what you said, as you think about what the longer term consequences are, look, the U.S.-European relationship will be scratchy. I wrote a piece a few weeks ago in The Atlantic saying, let's remember that it's always been scratchy. But the nuclear point is a very sensitive one. And I tend to think in the long run that you'll have more European states looking at nuclear weapons. I mean, I've said this before. I've been very struck talking to Polish friends, certainly Ukrainians, even Swedes. I think you're headed for a different nuclear order in Europe. You know, it's conceivable that maybe people with deep pockets will pay the Brits to begin investing in tactical nuclear weapons. I mean, I think the nuclear tectonic plates are beginning to shift a bit, which actually is probably a pretty good segue, unless you have anything else you want to say on this one, to the end of New START. So this is, look, I'm going to confess something. In graduate school, you know, because that was the thing back then, I had to study all this nuclear strategy stuff, and it made my head ache, and I had trouble sleeping at night. So I just ignored it and hoped it would go away. But you're made of sterner stuff. I've known that for a long time. So let me quiz you a bit. First, wondering the big news, another piece of big news this week is, okay, New START has expired. Could you first tell our listeners what was New START?
So New START was a bilateral U.S.-Russian strategic nuclear arms control agreement that was negotiated by the Obama administration in 2010 and ratified by the Senate, went into effect in February of 2011. It had a 10-year time limit, and it was set to expire in February of 2021. The Biden administration came into office, in its defense, with very little time to consider the treaty. Those of us who, you know, have lived with this nightmare in their heads for a very long time and have had to have some responsibility for some of this, some of us advised that maybe there should be some kind of conditional rollover of the agreement. That is to say, to tell the Russians, yes, we'll roll it over for 1 year or 2 years, but we expect to see actual real progress on some of the issues that were left unaddressed by the treaty, which I'll get to in a minute. And or inclusion of China in these discussions, because China is involved right now in a very large military buildup of its own, which seems likely aimed at making China a nuclear peer of both the United States and of Russia. The Biden administration, in its infinite wisdom, chose not to do that and exercised the five-year option that was in the treaty that just unconditionally rolled over the treaty for 5 years, which then set its expiration for February 6th, 2026, last week. The treaty is interesting in the sense that although the Obama administration touted it as leading to some of the biggest reductions in the post-Cold War era, in fact, it was the first treaty that arguably allowed the parties to build up their nuclear forces. The Strategic Offensive Reductions Treaty that the Bush 43 administration agreed to with Russia back in 2002 had had reduced significantly from the START II treaty that had been negotiated in the Clinton administration from a level of roughly 6,600 weapons down to each side had a range of between 1,700 and I think it was 2,200, but don't hold me to that. Number of deployed warheads. And our plans were to go down right to that 1,700 level. What was agreed in New START was a level of 1,550 warheads, which sounds like it's a decrease of some kind from the SWORT level. But because of the arcane nature of arms control, which has these different units of account to be able to try and create a balanced agreement between forces that are that are different. I mean, the composition of Russian forces and U.S. forces divided among bombers, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and submarine launched ballistic missiles are different. So you have different units of account, but in this treaty, you had, deployed warheads was the metric, but for bombers, each bomber ended up counting as one, despite the fact that we know you can load out bombers with more air-launched cruise missiles or gravity bombs than one in a plane. So in fact, the numbers were somewhat illusory.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Time is valuable. That's why Lowe's Blueprint Takeoffs turn blueprints into quotes faster. Bring us your plans, and we'll generate itemized material lists to make quoting easier so you can get back to building. Plus, at the Lowe's Pro Desk, you get access to thousands of building materials not sold in store. And when your order's ready, we'll deliver everything to the job site. Improving is easy at Lowe's.
There's been a lot of hue and cry about this. Frank Miller, my frequent partner in crime in writing about these issues. And Frank,
you've basically written something that says, don't worry, be happy.
Don't worry, be happy. I agree. That's the way to put it. The idea, Frank, truly expert in this, Frank actually was at the direction of then Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, was the person who went through the entire single integrated operational plan and reduced it, the target set, so we didn't have these tremendous amounts of overkill that were built into the nuclear war planning, where we had seven, warheads on every target. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but we had multiple, warheads on targets. Frank and I have written that although there's been a lot of in the arms control industrial complex, wailing and gnashing of teeth and rending of garments about how this is going to lead to a new arms race, the reality is there's not likely to be much of a new arms race for the following reasons. First of all, the Russians for the last decade and a half have been engaged in a major nuclear weapons modernization program. Couple of different new road mobile ICBMs, a new heavy ICBM that they've built, new submarine launch ballistic missiles, upgraded bombers, and air launch cruise missiles. So they have been building up their nuclear forces for 15 years, and they're coming to the end of that program. They also built a number of weapons that were not covered by the treaty. I mean, first of all, the treaty did not cover so-called tactical nuclear weapons. I hate the term tactical nuclear weapons because, as one wag put it, a tactical, whether you think it's tactical or strategic, is equal to your square root, of the distance from the ground zero. A quote tactical nuclear weapon in Estonia, would have a strategic effect. So these are weapons that, basically they're meant to use as part of theater campaigns rather than large general nuclear war. They have usually shorter range, lower yield, and are called tactical because they were not easily visible to overhead satellite photography, which was the means of verification for most of
them. And also people expected them to be used on the battlefield. Against massed armored forces, but that's no longer really...
No longer really a thing. Those were not covered by the treaty at all. And the Russians had a very large advantage, and that's now become an issue. Because obviously in 2011, when the treaty was ratified, we were not dealing with the revanchist Russia that had launched two invasions of a neighbor and was threatening all of Europe with nuclear weapons, you know, on its main television channels every night. The PRC has been engaged for a number of years now in a buildup, which the Pentagon's China Nuclear Power reports has suggested is by the mid-30s and maybe earlier, they will have deployed about 1,500 warheads. And they've shown no interest in, despite, you know, repeated efforts by the first Trump administration and the Biden administration to talk about these things, Chinese are not interested because getting involved in these kinds of negotiations would involve a level of transparency that they see as, you know, sort of spying by the West and sign of weakness on their part. It's not likely to, you know, to be changed by anything that we do. In the meantime, we have a problem because our forces have not been modernized. We agreed to a modernization program as part of the Senate's price for ratifying New START in 2010. But those programs are, by and large, behind schedule and over budget for a whole bunch of reasons, some of which could have been foreseen, some of which really couldn't be foreseen. But so we're very early in the stages of our nuclear modernization program in the face of very advanced modernization by our two major adversaries. Moreover, we face a problem we've never faced since the advent of nuclear weapons, which is how do you deter not one, just one adversary, but how do you deter two at the same time?
And of course, those two adversaries in some situations look at each other as well.
Although they also, you know, have announced a partnership without limits. Yeah. So,
although I mean, I remember having one conversation. I forget when this was, but it was, you know, where the Russians were making very clear that they would not talk about, let's call it, theater nuclear weapons, of which they have thousands. And the reason, you know, when pressed why, they said Siberia. You know, we've got 15 right. million people right next to China.
Sure. Right.
So I guess, I mean, let me ask, just because we got other stuff to talk about. We've got a couple of big questions here. One is this basically it for arms control, A? And B, to what extent do the numbers really matter? I mean, once you've gotten beyond the threshold of a kind of a survivable deterrent, you know, they could throw a first punch, but you could still, you know, devastate 100, 200 cities. Does it matter? So those are two very big questions. If you could, you know, just say what your views of both of those are.
Yeah, they are big questions and probably require us to bring Frank on and have a real...
We should do that.
...serious conversation about nuclear targeting, about which he is really expert. I'm really more of an amateur. But so on the first question, I think arms control, not likely in the near term. But one of the lessons from the Cold War history of arms control is if you want to get the other side to sit down and negotiate with you, you have to actually be deploying things they want to limit. And that's why moving forward with our modernization program as rapidly as we can, including, by the way, nuclear command and control, a subject about which I'm just finishing a monograph that we can talk about when it comes out later this spring. That's an important part of this as well, because if you can't actually control and you know, use your weapons in war, you don't have a deterrent. So that's number one. On the numbers question, this has been a debate that has raged since the beginning of the Cold War. You know, some people have said, you know, 15 weapons is enough or 50 weapons is enough, because if you can blow up a bunch of cities, well... I mean, that was sort of what we had for, you know, deterrent for, you know, quite a while in the early Cold War before we had this buildup in the 50s and 60s that got us to these astronomical levels of weapons. The question is about deterrence, not one about, you know, sort of what you in a rational world think would deter the other side, because you can't really know. because it goes on. This is a point Henry Kissinger used to make. The problem with deterrence is it goes on in the mind of your adversary, you know. And so what you think deters is interesting, but not, you know, dispositive. This was the big mistake I think McNamara made, which is he came up with this idea of assured destruction. If we destroy some percentage of the Russian population and industry, that'll deter them. Well, it might have deterred us, but we have no clue whether it would have deterred the Russians. In fact, we have some reason to believe, based on what we've learned from the Russians afterwards, they didn't think about it at all the same way we did. So there's that. Second, you have to hold at risk as part of deterrence what your adversary values most. And what we have come to learn about these systems is what matters most is their hold on power and their military assets. And so you want to be able to hold those at risk. We've also, by the way, come to the conclusion, and our lawyers do actually, operating under the law of armed conflict, do have to review our nuclear war plans. And deliberate targeting of populations and urban population centers is, prohibited, essentially. This does get fuzzy because a lot of the military assets we want to target are located, in areas where there are large concentrations of people. So inevitably, you're going to, kill civilians. But the question becomes, what do your adversaries really think? You're just going to blow up a bunch of cities for no purpose? You really have to be able to go after the leadership and the military targets. And in that sense, the numbers can matter. And to the problem for deterring too is this: the canonical view of stability in the Cold War was, as you said, the ability to absorb a first strike, but then still have enough that you could inflict unacceptable damage on the adversary. Okay, well, so if the Russians have 1,500 and the Chinese have 1,500 and we have 1,500, how many can you absorb in a first strike and then still have enough to deter not only one, but two of them, when the other one's going to have an untouched, untouched arsenal? So we don't have the answer. I don't think we know the answer to that yet, but it probably, this is a little bit like Justice Potter Stewart's definition of pornography. I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. 1,550 against 3,000, that's probably not the right number. I don't think we need to match them weapon for weapon, but we probably do need to do some upload.
All right. This stuff continues to give me a headache, but I think you're right. We ought to have Frank Miller on as well. Let's, time is moving on. We've got several other topics. So the administration has announced that a second aircraft carrier, the Gerald Ford, last seen keeping an eye on Venezuela, is going to move to the Persian Gulf, setting aside the issues of wear and tear on the carrier's crews and all that. The impression that I think I'm getting is, first, the sort of confusion about aims on our side. What exactly are we negotiating with the Iranians about? Is it their nuclear program? Is it their ballistic missile program? Is it the support for proxies? Is it their domestic behavior? Not clear to me that the administration knows what it's negotiating about. But it also seems to me that the Iranians, as they often have in the past, are thinking that they've taken their measure of the administration, and they can haggle with them now. And I'll just say one other thing, then I'd like to hear your take. The more I read their pronouncements, and the more I think about that kind of regime, the more I tend to think that the senior leadership, the people calling the shots, do not have a very good grasp on reality. And, they're living in a world which would feel very, very strange to us in terms of how they assess us, what they think is happening to them, how they assess their own strength, how they assess their own ability to endure shocks, their ability to strike back. So I guess my bottom line is, if I had to bet, I would say at least there's a very serious chance, and maybe even a slight probability, that we end up with another round of Iran strikes, but we're not quite sure for what.
That sounds exactly right to me. So the on the confusion of aims, you know, Witkoff initially said nuclear program, missile program, proxies. The president, of course, said when the big demonstrations were going on, help is on the way to the demonstrators. Of course, you know, it's been a long windup, but nothing, you know, has actually been there to help the protesters. Secretary Rubio and Vice President Vance have both in comments suggested, oh, yeah, human rights and the, you know, the treatment of population by the regime is, you know, something we're going to either have discussed or will discuss. The Iranians claim the only thing they're willing to talk about is the nuclear program. Prime Minister Netanyahu just was in Washington meeting with the president saying, no, the nuclear program, it's all entombed, you know, in the facilities you bombed in June with Midnight Hammer. What really worries us Israelis is the missile program. Got to go after the missile program. President basically said, hey, you know, I'm predisposed to diplomacy first. And yesterday, I think he said, you know, it's about a month. We got about a month here while this huge force is sitting out there and additional forces are augmenting it. And another complication is that a number of our Arab allies have said, you can't use your bases in our territory to fly missions against Iran. So that's why one reason why you're getting a second carrier, you're going to need more, you know, carrier-based assets to fly missions. It's why we've seen more and more tankers going out there, tanking capability, because they're going to have to refuel these guys. And why they've had more stuff kind of on the periphery of the region to engage in strikes. Although the Iranians have said, if there's a strike, it's going to lead to a regional war and we'll attack all the bases, you know, in these Arab neighbors, which has meant that we have needed to, you know, augment all the air and missile defense assets in the region. So we've really been driven to a very, very large buildup. And I don't know, president said a month, I don't know how long you can set, you know, leave that sitting out there without actually doing something. And to your point about the Iranians overplaying their hand, which I think is a real possibility, one of the things, according to various reports we've seen, that they've proposed is, okay, we could downblend all the 60% HEU we have down to 20%. That would be the big concession they would make. When, of course, the Obama-era agreement limited them to no more than 3% enrichment to begin with. I mean, so how the president sells this as a huge advance, you know, and, you know, stopping their nuclear program and a huge advance over what existed in the past, it kind of eludes me. And are they going to go after the missiles and say, okay, we got the missile program. Okay, that's one thing. If they're really going to try and kind of knock the regime, you know, out, that would probably require more than a one and done kind of strike.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
There's some other straws in the wind, one of which is there have been reports that we've been smuggling a lot of Starlink terminals into Iran to keep connectivity, because the regime has basically shut down the internet for the whole country, which is something. So that's one thing. Second,
I hope that's true.
I mean, who knows? But I wouldn't be at all surprised. I mean, this is a technically sophisticated population, and you know they've always had lots of antennas on the rooftops. Secondly, the regime has gotten even more repressive. They've been going after pro-government reformers lately. So people basically who backed the current president, Pezeshkian. The numbers of people who were killed and the extent of repression, I think it's become clear this is really monstrous levels, thousands and thousands of people. The sense that something in the regime is broken, that the population is really, this is just it. So what I can imagine is that they're getting reports which say the regime is fragile. And who knows if they've gotten any overtures from people in the IRGC? Who knows what the impact of the Maduro experience? Because, you know, one thing that I think we have to say, in all honesty, is removing Maduro is kind of, it's worked so far. You know, there was just a poll today I was looking at. Venezuelans, very happy Maduro's gone.
Right. They're happy that the Americans are holding Delcy Rodriguez and the government to all these, right, you know, strictures. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, my guess is they may be thinking about that as a potential
model. Trump has said that. He's made the comparison to Venezuela a couple of times.
You know, I think there's always been sense here that, you know, they learn from their previous experiences and they interpret them correctly or not. You know, we could find out, and they may very well be right. And then I've always thought that lurking in the background, which people don't seem to discuss, and I don't understand why, is the Iranians tried to kill Trump. And I mean, I don't know about you. I would take that personally. And I don't think Donald Trump is as nice a guy as I am. So I would suspect that even though he thinks politics is a rough sport, he thinks that, you know, he would, there's a part of him that's saying, yeah, I'll really kind of swat him. And what I can imagine him doing is authorize, you know, so if you follow that through, what's the logic of the operation? The logic of the operation is probably something that kills Khamenei and some of the top IRGC leadership. And then, you know, and then you say to a successor regime, I mean, a successor leadership, which would be thuggish, but they have no problems dealing with thugs. And it's probably inevitable anyway, as Stephen Kotkin pointed out in our interview a few weeks back, that then you begin making deals. And among, you know, part of the deals can be we kind of take the boot off your neck with regard to oil sanctions.
We do tend to forget that political leaders are human beings and they, you know, have emotions, and emotions play a much bigger role in a lot of this stuff than, you know, than IR theory might lead you to believe. It's sort of like that scene in The Godfather where Sterling Hayden plays a police captain who punches, you know, Michael Corleone in the face when he's trying to protect his father in the hospital. And afterwards, Sonny Corleone is saying, you know, you're taking this very, very personal, Mike. You know?
Yeah. There are two other things to talk about. One is, and here again, I'll not that I'm singing the praises of the Trump administration, but it is very interesting to me that Starlink in the Russian use of Starlink has been turned off. Now maybe Elon Musk is just doing this on his own, and that's conceivable because he's a complicated figure in some ways, but I would tend to think that the administration is probably somehow involved in this as well. And it is striking that it does seem to have affected their ability to, you know, maneuver, their ability to conduct longer range strikes and so on. And I think it's probably part of what they think of as the end game of a negotiation, where they're increasing the pressure, because they're increasing the pressure on the Russians in other ways, including going after the shadow fleet. So I was wondering if you had any take on that.
Yeah. So the Starlink thing is really interesting. I don't know, you know, whether the administration had a hand in it or not, or whether that, you know, SpaceX just found out that, you know, the Russians had this massive, sanction evasions effort and got a hold of all these, you know, Starlink terminals illicitly and decided to just, you know, shut them off. As you say, it's had a real impact on the long range, you know, interdiction campaign that that the Russians have been waging relatively successfully against Ukrainian logistics. And so it's really slowed up their advance. I mean, I think in January, I just saw the figures this morning, the Russians suffered the largest single month loss. I think it was 9,000 killed, which is like insane, you know, numbers. And you see all these anecdotal reports of labor shortages and personnel shortages. They're recruiting people from Southeast Asia, from India, Africa to go and fight on the front line. And they're really, you know, under some pressure. By the same token, you know, it's the pressure, whatever pressure the Russians are under from the administration, including Ghost Fleet and losing all their, you know, proxies in Syria and in Venezuela and elsewhere. I don't think it's part of a concerted effort by the administration to pressure Russia. It's unintended consequence, but it doesn't really, in my mind, balance out, you know, the 99% reduction in support for Ukraine from the U.S. and the pressure that we're putting them on to do crazy things like have a referendum and election, you know, by May 15th, so we could get an agreement by June. President saying the Russians really want a deal. Well, I mean, there's all these leaks about the Russians have dangled all this, you know, Kirill Dmitriev, the head of the Russian sovereign wealth fund, has dangled all this stuff in front of Kushner and Witkoff, you know, $13 trillion in deals that we can do. I mean, the entire GDP of Russia is $2.5 trillion. This is like, they're talking about something 5.5 times. Sure. Yeah, we want American capital to rebuild an economy that we destroyed with a stupid war and stupid policies. Who wouldn't want that deal? But I don't see the makings of a deal in the negotiations. I just saw that before we came on the air that the Russian leader, the Russian delegation for the new talks that are going to allegedly take place next week in Geneva, is former culture minister Medinsky, who was, you know, who presided over previous failed rounds of negotiation, in distinction to the ones that were held in Abu Dhabi, where you had military talking to military, where they actually seem to have made some progress. So I don't see the mix, you know, makings of a deal here.
No, I don't. And in fact, I think having Medinsky there is actually a signal that the Russians are not going to be serious, because he's, you know, he's sort of an ideologue. And he's not
rewrite all the history books with this phantasmagoric history of Russia.
He's not the guy who would appeal to American interlocutors either. That's one of the curious things about it. Listen,
I think Witkoff asked them not to send him back.
Yeah. But then the question is, you know, what does that tell you? I mean, I would revert to my earlier point about the Iranians, that, you know, we think the Trump administration exists in a bubble, that whatever bubble the Iranians exist in and that the Russians exist in is, or the Chinese, I think Xi Jinping as well, it's a much worse bubble. I mean, probably the Russians and Iranians more than the Chinese, but you know, it's just a different world.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal, $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Listen, the last thing I thought, we've only got a couple of minutes. I think like you, you know, I sort of followed some of the Epstein stuff and I was disgusted by it.
Who wouldn't be?
It's utterly revolting. But I have to say, the more stuff comes out, first, the more revolting it is. And I think possibly the more politically significant it is. There's a very interesting piece in the New York Times, by the way, about how they're, I think one of the reasons why I think there'll be more stuff that's going to drop, New York Times, which has a lot of resources, has 24 journalists working on this with AI tools and so on. So they're sifting through 3 million documents, 2,000 videos. I mean, it's a major enterprise. And there are a couple of things that really strike me about it. First, you know, the level of criminality here may be very considerable, including possibly even murder, you know, torture videos and stuff like that. But I think there, one political consequence is I think people don't let go of this one. And, you know, it was very interesting that some of the Republican women were the people going after Pam Bondi on this. I think that's significant. But I think the other thing, there's something deeper here, which is, and I think you see this in the reaction overseas, even more than in the United States. This is a kind of an indictment of the elites that have been running Western countries for decades and decades now. And, you know, there's always tension. You know, people don't like elites, you know, for perfectly good reasons. But I think the idea that they're just kind of bottomless corruption and venality and perversion and it's very powerful. It's and I think it does augur again an era of very turbulent politics, even when people like Trump are gone from the scene.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, you know, symptomatic of what you just said was the announcement today that Kathy Rumler, who was President Obama's White House counsel, and who, and you cannot make this up, right? Her current position is at Goldman Sachs in charge of reputation management. She's resigning because of, you know, the emails she exchanged with Epstein, which showed her not only very chummy with Epstein, but trying to help him, you know, arrange his defense around the second set of charges in 2018 and 19. And also having received, you know, all sorts of gifts from him that she was outfitted with, you know, clothing and, you know, high-end clothing and bags and whatnot. The thing that I think people have not focused on enough, though, is all the Russian connections here.
Yes.
I mean, one of his main interlocutors was Sergei Belyakov, who is a graduate of the FSB Academy and who was in charge for many years of putting together Putin's showcase, St. Petersburg International Economic Forum. But there are other Russians all over this.
A lot of young Russian women, of course.
A lot of young Russian women, some of whom may have been trafficked by Epstein. Epstein's MO seems to be right out of the, you know, FSB, KGB kind of, you know, manual, which is kompromat, you know, get people into compromising positions, videotape them, and then blackmail them. You know, I don't have an answer. I don't know kind of what it all means. But the fact that he was engaged with these people for a very long time, that he was moving money with them, I think Deutsche Bank was, if I'm not mistaken, was fined for having engaged in some of those transactions. He was friends with Donald Trump for 15 years before they fell out. And the falling out was over not masseuses at Mar-a-Lago, which is what the president would like us all to think, but over a dispute about a piece of property in Palm Beach, which Trump ultimately sold to a Russian oligarch at a hefty profit. I don't have answers, and I don't know what it all means. But I think there's something there that needs to be looked at, and I worry that the attention is all on the very prurient parts of this, for understandable reasons, when there really are some national security elements here that people really ought to be looking at very closely.
Yeah, I've got a feeling this is not the last time we'll be discussing this. Well, on that cheery and uplifting note, Eric, have a great weekend.
You too, my friend.